Phil Parr, welcome now to Blind Like Me again for this week. Thank you for letting me come into your homes. Most folks won't let an old drunk musician in their home, but obviously you're a little more liberal than that because here I am, right here in your home. Before we get started, this fellow that caught this gentleman we have on today that emailed me said Bob Bartlett finally harassed him enough to call me. So we like to give credit where credit is due to our friend Bob Bartlett from Houston, Texas, who is, if he's vice president of Texas ACB, but he's very involved in the ACB of Texas, and a fella, another one of those wonderful people that I just love and would never have met had we not started doing this little program. Louis Mayer, how are you, sir?
Fine, thank you, Bob.
Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
Phil, you're Louis, and yeah. We'll do fine.
Yeah.
You're down in Houston, Texas, isn't
right.
It? Down in a little hot.
And we're eagerly awaiting the thunderstorm, which you apparently are having now.
Well, we're having it, or we're fixing to have it. I can't determine which it is. It's thunder, and that always bothers me when I'm out here in the studio, you know, a little bit. You kind of wonder about things like that. But anyway, we'll survive, I think, a little thunderstorm. How you took off from your job today, which is with what company?
ExxonMobil Exploration Company.
And you've been there how long, you said?
24 years.
24 years. And your what is your level of vision?
Zero.
Absolutely none. Just as blind as blind as I am. Well, let's get back in early times. How did that happen? Did you start out like that?
I started out with fairly stable but very low vision as a kid. They tried to put me through normal school in the first grade, and it wasn't working out. I had a 10-power lens, which if you ever dealt with one of those, it has a 1-inch focal length, and which means you're 1 inch from the paper. And I only could see capital letters, and so we tried to the first grade with that, and it didn't work. So on the summer of my first grade year, it's an amazing story. I had a first grade teacher, her name was Mrs. Wright, and she took off and learned Braille she had nothing to do with it beforehand, but she learned Braille and came back and was my special teacher from grades 2 to 5 in Dallas.
And so she
taught me the Braille code and math, Nemeth code, and everything else. So what I did, I went through school with a very large pencil. I could make letters an inch higher, so I did a mixture of that and Braille. And my vision stayed fairly stable for the rest of my, educational career. Then when I went to ExxonMobil, or when I was in graduate school, I got up with a VTech. Remember the company sold closed circuit television systems.
Uh-huh.
I had one of the earlier ones of those, and it was some use. But what I found is I couldn't read for more than 20 minutes. I never could read fast, and after that, my eyes just got—it was too painful. In about 1985, my retina totally failed, and so I converted totally to blind methods. I'd used them mostly anyway due to early training and sort of thing, and Braille displays and JAWS voice output systems and that sort of thing. So that's my level of expertise, and I'm still slowly trying to improve. I learned the slate very late in life. I knew the Braille writer for a long time, but the slate very late, and I really enjoy the slate. I know our friend Bob considers slates to be like bare flint and not, you know, just bare technology.
Yeah.
But it's so, when I learned it the last 4 to 5 years, it's such a powerful thing to be able to carry a Braille writing capability around with you, take notes. My memory is not what it was, and it's easy just to load up some 8x5 index cards with what do you need on a traveling, you know, your plane numbers and phone numbers and hotels and take notes in hotels and things like that. So it's just, I guess I would push the Braille methods very strongly, and I think they help me a great deal.
Well, some things work for one blind person, some for another. But you say, back a little bit, this lady went to went to school to learn Braille because of you.
Yes, she did. She knew our family. I'm unaware of a lot of this detail of the background. I mean, I was I met her first sort of in kindergarten, and she was sort of tutoring me because they knew they were going to be trouble, going to have problems. The school was a Catholic, Christ the King Catholic school in Dallas, and it didn't have any special education programs. Anyway, so they were trying to get me through kindergarten and first grade, and they decided after that was just hopeless, and I would have to convert over to, hopeless using print methods. My parents decided I would learn Braille. And this lady, for whatever reasons, she took the summer off and intensively learned Braille. And then I was tutored 3 times a week after school in Braille, writing and printing and then math and this sort of thing. And she also did a lot of interlining, which if I brailed an assignment for other classes and things, she would write in. I brailed and she would write on top of what I wrote so that the sighted teacher could see it. And anyway, she was, you might call her an itinerant or special education teacher. She had her normal job, but she also did this for me up through my fifth grade year. And this is one of the most remarkable person. It's probably the most remarkable person I've ever run across in my life. I've lost track of her because kids are unaware of their environment and don't pay attention to it much. Things are just there, come and go, and they don't pay attention.
But it didn't mean nearly as much to you that she had done that at that point in your life as it, and looking back on it, as it does now.
It's extremely remarkable. I mean, it's just incredible. You know, the love, the gift of literacy and this sort of thing, and just the time, the effort. So, and she didn't have to do any of it. It was all volunteer. I don't know if she ever got paid much extra for doing it. But she
I was going to say, I think it's Ziegler Magazine has an award for the sighted person who helped blind people most in the last year, and you can nominate, because we don't know where she is. So
no, we don't, and I've lost track, and it's been a long time, 50 years.
It's been a long, long time ago, hasn't it? Probably not alive anymore.
Yeah.
But that was a wonderful thing for her to do. Of course, she probably, in retrospect, she might have had to do some continuing education anyway, and she figured, well, this is going to help this blind child. Yeah. And like you said, she knew the family, and there was a need for that, so she filled that need. Now the state mandates it, or the federal government, or somebody mandates it.
Well, they mandate it in principle, but in execution, it doesn't work so good sometimes. You know, giving the kids need. I had, during school time, I almost had daily special education for learning Braille, even though, extra outside school 3 times a week, but also inside school about an hour a day. What I'm saying is, I don't think kids get the intensive Braille training that they need by people who know Braille. I think, it's mandated, but not enough Braille teachers around or this sort of thing to get it executed correctly.
There aren't enough. In fact, that would be, if you were going to be a teacher, if you had planned, I was telling one of my nieces, if you planned to be a teacher, being a VI teacher would be a good thing because there's a hell of a shortage of them.
Yeah.
I think Don's wife is working for 3 or 4 different school districts, I think, now.
Yeah.
She is a qualified VA teacher. And, of course, Don is an expert. I'm talking about Don Patterson, that does the Handyman Show, is a Braille expert. He learned Braille, yet he has good sight, so he can read Braille with his eyes.
That's incredible. And I think it leads to great headaches, I would imagine. But
I would think it would. I would think it would. So your parents were, you were in Dallas, Dallas, Texas, and they tried to treat you. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes. We had 8 children in our family.
Really?
7 brothers and sisters, 3 girls, 5 boys. I ended up being the favorite child a little bit because I had more gadgets. I mean, the other kids, I think, could look at it and say yes, because I had magnifiers and things like that and more educational opportunities, but more training on the outside. Mm-hmm. I consider it was a big pain because I was, forced to take typing in the third grade and in the summer, and I was outraged by this whole offense, but,
Really?
But I think my parents tried to treat us all equally as they could, and I got more stuff for more attention.
Yeah.
But that's the way it was. And I don't think there's any too many lasting scars over that or something like that, but it's an effect that blind child is probably going to require more attention.
That's what I was going to say. You got more attention because you had to have more attention.
Yeah, you had to have more.
In order to be on an equal footing, you had to have, My computer setup is a lot more expensive than my wife's because I've got $900, $1,100 worth of jaws on it. So, So that's that. So you got through high school. You never went to a blind school? Never?
I never did, and I never knew any blind people. I met one or two growing up. I never met any blind people. Well, I mean, you might see one or two, but I never was associated with them or knew anybody till sometime in mid-90s, early 90s. because there just weren't any in my world. I went to Jesuit High School. I went to Spring Hill College in Mobile, Alabama. Then I went to the University of Texas at Dallas and eventually got a PhD in physics in there, and then worked what's called a postdoctoral, a couple of those jobs with Rice University and with a small company called Radio Physics Incorporated in Boulder, Colorado, which is could be my most favorite place in the world. It wouldn't take much to declare that. And then moved back to Houston, married, worked for ExxonMobil since 1981, and here I am now. Still there.
And you say that you never really were associated with many blind people until the mid-90s?
Yes. There just weren't any in my world.
And you were 50 what, 650?
I'm 55 now.
55 now, so that's...
So I was 40, 43, 40, somewhere in there.
Before you ever really were around any...
Blind individual.
What you'd call successful or well-adjusted blind people.
Any.
Or any, I
yes,
guess, any.
On both counts.
If you call Bob Bartlett well-adjusted, I mean...
Well, I knew Bob. I met him later when
you
I
have
started
to qualify that,
working on the organized blind areas.
Yeah, that's amazing, see. That's, you know, that's...
Well, you hear the term small incidents, and
and
if you're not in the blind world... It just is. They're not there. They're not visible. They're just not there. And even in my workplace, there are not any except me.
Yeah.
And, so it's not hard to not meet any blind individuals.
No, I can understand that. I just find that unusual. I mean, I just I've never talked to anybody who went that long without being around somebody. Like, my work. World, when I worked in radio, I didn't see any blind people, but I went to school with hundreds of them. I mean, I knew a lot of blind people. I wasn't associated with them, but you went to public school and then you went on to...
it's Catholic private, and I had a tutor just on the outside, but it was one-on-one lessons through the eighth grade, and then that's my formal tutoring ended, and, I've taken some courses from Hadley, which I really like those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I took grade 3 Braille, which is really strange stuff if you ever had it.
No.
Anyway, I work with Hadley a little bit, but no formal training after the eighth grade.
As far as the blindness field.
Yeah.
And you had enough vision, and they would allow you to make, to write your, to type. I guess you could type your assignments.
Well, yes, I was typed, though not terribly accurately. When you can't see your own, with a 10-power lens, you can get 1 inch from where the keys strike the paper, and you could use liquid paper, but it got awful slow. And without knowing exactly what you typed, I mean, you touch type, and you know what you're typing, sort of, but my spelling wasn't that good, and my typing probably wasn't that good. It was understandable, but not wonderful.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. A lot of blind people did a lot of typing back then, but they had no idea what was coming out. Or even if they were typing, the ribbon might be out. You might type for hours, and then somebody say, "Well, there's nothing there." So,
or you make some mistakes on a page, and you go, "Oh, it's a page order, right?"
There's no way you start over. If you made two or three mistakes, you just start over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but sounds like you've certainly. You adjusted well. You say that you went off to Alabama to college. Why? What did?
Okay, it's a Jesuit college, and my father had been in World War II, and he trained. The Navy trained a lot of pilots in Alabama and Florida, and he had gotten to love the place during because he took navigation from them. It's a Jesuit college there. And he took navigation from them, and so he went to school there ultimately, and wanted me to go there. When I was a senior in high school, I didn't really know where I wanted to go, so I went there as his recommendation. So, and it worked out really well.
But you, at that point in time, still had a little vision.
Yes, I did. And I could, again, read with a 10-power lens, sort of, but not very much. My books were in Braille. My parents ran all the interference for me in high school of acquiring books, and I didn't fully realize how hard it was because that became my job when I got into college. There are no Braille books in college, and I don't know if there are still any now. I don't think there are too much. But for recordings for the blind and dyslexic, it was my job to get the books.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, you had to get the books like in January for the September courses. I ran into a guy at the ACB convention. He's going to school in Austin, and he was going to let the school system provide him with books. He didn't know what courses he was going to taking, and he was going to, on a week's notice, expect books to appear. Now, whether it does or not, or whether he was just being super naive or not, this is incredible. Either it's great progress or he's kidding himself.
He's kidding himself.
I think so.
I think you still have to let them know in advance. There are lots of people now who will transcribe books to Braille, and it's much easier to do now with a computer, as you know, with the computer technology to scan the book in. But to proof it and get it right would take. I think he's being very naive.
Yeah, he's a freshman, and I mean he's going to be a freshman, and he was depending on the disabled student services officers to take care of him. And I'm thinking his guy's due for a shock, but I don't know. In our day, this sounds ancient. You did it all. You found your courses, talked to each professor, and professors hate to decide books, but you have to persuade them to decide, and get the books in like February to recordings if you wanted anything in September.
If you wanted it in September. Now, this college, but you had sight enough to get around campus. That wasn't going to be a problem.
Yeah, I didn't really use a cane. no driving or anything like that. But and I could, even at that point, ride a bicycle to a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
And I have what's called a monoscope or a 10-power lens, 8-power lens, monocular one.
Yeah.
And I could read street signs and see traffic lights with that. Although, it cuts your field of vision way down. So I was looking at these traffic lights, and you're sitting at this intersection staring at the traffic light, and you're listening to all the traffic around you, and people must have thought you out of your mind because you're not looking at the cars around you. But
that's a good story because you're not looking at the cars and people think what is wrong with this boy?
Yeah,
because you can, and a lot of that you're doing listening to try to figure out which way the traffic's going.
Or you're just got your monoscope pointed at the traffic light.
Yeah, to see which color it's going to turn.
Yeah, and that's all you can do.
Yeah.
But don't do that anymore. No more bike riding.
No more bike riding. That's all over. Well, as I've said before, I know a blind kid who rode a bicycle through a plate glass window.
I tried, and what I found out for parked cars will destroy you. I mean, I rode for a little bit on the street, but then, parked car, and that's it. Collide, and no thank you anymore.
Yeah, I sold brooms door-to-door and parked cars. People park cars across driveways. You'd be walking down the sidewalk, and there'd be some guy with his car backed out and across the sidewalk. So, boom, there you were.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take a little short break. We want to go back and get back into your college, your years, and some other jobs that you might have had or things that you might have done. Back in just a minute with more of our show called Blind Like Me.
Blind Like Me list that I'll never forget.
Well, them crazy people on that Blind Like Me list just talk about the silliest thing.
To join the Blind Like Me list, send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Okay, I love being on the Blind Like Me list because I'm the moderator, and I get to delete people if I want to.
If you enjoy chatting with other blind folks, come join us on the Blind Like Me list. Send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Well, the whole point of the Blind Handyman Show is blind people have as many plumbing problems and household repairs to do as sighted people do, but we can't do them exactly the same way sighted people do, so we need some input from other blind people to find out how they do household repairs, and so we formed this Blind Handyman, and we got a list going. As far as Blind Like Me is concerned, it's we want to use it as an educational tool. As I remember being a young adult, a young person, and thinking, well, I want a nice house and as kids and a good job, but how am I going to do that? And I had no idea. And I think the Blind Like Me show demonstrates the fact that it can be done even if you are blind. That's not a handicap. It can be done.
If you would like to be a guest on either show, or you can suggest someone as a guest, email us at blindhandyman@hotmail.com or blindlikeme@txucom.net.
Well, so far, it's been a labor of love. Our guest is Lewis Mayer from from the Bayou City, from Houston, Texas. Personal friend of Bob Bartlett's, member of ACB, works at ExxonMobil, took the afternoon off, especially to come and be a guest on our Blind Like Me show. So you completed a four-year degree at this university in Alabama, is that correct?
Yes, Spring Hill College in Mobile, Alabama.
And what was that degree in?
BS in physics.
In physics?
Yeah.
My, you need to meet my friend Max Robinson, who also has a degree in physics.
Good.
Max has some side also.
Mm-hmm.
Max is very, very much into electronics, and he's on our ACB list. We'll try to get you two together, and I'm sure you'd have a good bit to talk about in physics. Now, what did you think a old half-blind boy was going to do with a degree in physics? Just be honest.
I learned to love science fiction, you know, from the books from the Library of Congress. So I love science fiction all my life. And wanted to do physics of all space science related physics, and also just I find interesting trying to understand, you know, how energy moves through matter, how a matter focuses it, and how you can use energy to image matter underground or in space or, you know, in the atmosphere. Anyway, the whole idea of space intrigues me, and as to what you're going to do with it, well, what you do, you in some respects you take the course of least resistance when you come out of college and go to graduate school if you're not quite sure.
Yeah.
So that's what I did, and plus, if you want to do any research in physics, you have to get a PhD degree. And so I did that at University of Texas at Dallas.
Okay.
And that took a long time. That took 6.5 years.
Six and a half years to complete graduate school?
Yes.
Well, what was the hurry, though, right?
Yeah. Well, I would have loved to get out earlier.
Well,
it seemed like all the married guys got out. Not quite half the time. I mean, a little more than half the time, but, I mean, they got out quicker. I guess they were due to motivation.
I assume that your parents were in Dallas and you moved back home. So what was the...
UT Dallas is... It's funny because it's in what's called Richardson, Texas. It's north of the main Dallas.
Yeah.
So I had to rent a house and sub-rent it to two of the students. My parents were about, you know, 30 miles away and visited a lot, and it was very nice, but... mostly we just, because it was very close to the school, you just, commute to the school and walk over.
Well, this puts you now at about 27, 28 years old.
Yeah, I was 29 when I got out of school, 1981.
And you had a PhD in physics.
Yes.
And very little sight.
Yes.
Did you have a game plan?
You sort of do. Your professors are, you know, UT Dallas, and I've lost track a little bit of it, but they had a strong space science program, and it's in partial alignment with Rice University. And so I worked between both schools, and there's a sort of a system of postdocs. Anyway, you send out all your resumes to various people. So I had sent out resumes and was accepted at Rice for one of the postdocs, which is a year-long effort just out of graduate school to, get yourself established. And there was some leftover Apollo data. Rice had an instrument on the moon, which they had taken a lot of data from, and they'd almost, this was 1979, they'd almost completed analysis, but not quite. And so I was hired on to help finish the data analysis on this instrument. And it was mostly measure plasma coming off the, they put instruments to measure hydrogen, oxygen, and different contents of the sun's solar wind, which would blow by the moon. And so I helped finish that and get some of it published in 1979.
Well, did you have enough sight to read these instruments?
All right, now this was very difficult, and I didn't do it as effectively. They had huge three-dimensional plots, that is to say, plots that would, long pieces of paper, like 50, 100, a couple hundred feet,
really?
And I could not really see them very well. I had a CCTV by that time, closed circuit television, and I could put a portion of those plots under it, and it was plotted in a three-dimensional manner, so you could sort of see bulges, but I couldn't get the details. I have never been that good in data analysis. The three things I talk about are lack of access to graphically displayed data, graphical user interfaces, and mathematics, and those are the three barriers that blind type individuals will have to deal with in science.
Yeah.
And I have not, by any means, mastered those three. So data analysis, I was not that good at. I could help with see some of it, read some. You can read numbers because the numbers at that time were on microfilm, and you could put your CCTV pointed at the microfilm reader and read those numbers that way, mm-hmm. or you can read computer printouts with television systems. But it's not a very effective way, and I wasn't that good at it, which is... let me tell you something about small research versus big research. In small research universities, a person sort of has to be able to do almost everything because they only have two or three people, and so you have to be multiversed.
Mm-hmm.
And this I didn't excel in because in the data analysis and also getting math and this sort of thing, I had problems. One, and I had two postdocs. I worked with planetary radio astronomy data, which was the Voyager data, which went by Jupiter and Saturn.
Uh-huh.
And I worked with that, and I had the same similar problems analyzing data. So ultimately, that's what's one of the reasons I went to big companies. In large companies, their work, they have a lot more their work is much more fine-grained. It's broken down into more components that you can do. There's a lot more things to do and more people to do them. So I've drifted into the computer programming field from the data analysis field, because I wasn't that effective in the data analysis or mathematical analysis. So I drifted into computer programming, and with ExxonMobil, I could still do a little bit of the data analysis and mathematics, but most of my job became programming. And that's how... That's one reason I think I've been relatively successful.
Okay, but at Rice University, did they know you couldn't see, but they knew that before you came?
Yeah, because they were friends. I mean, again, we had worked together. This was done in the 70s. When I was in graduate school, I knew the people there. The UT and Rice people worked together. And the space science field is a small field, and everybody knows everybody. So, yeah, they knew this.
And so there was somebody there willing to take a chance on you.
Patricia Rife. You ever get in Houston and the Museum of Natural Science? She's very active there in many other cases promoting astronomy and space science to the public. But Patricia Rife and a gentleman named Dick Wolf, those were the two who, and another individual named John Freeman, those were the three people at Rice who hired me and I did work for them while I was there. And Pat is very, very strong in space science and popularization of science. And they were willing to, let me see what I could do and give me a chance for that sort of thing.
Yeah, willing to take a chance on a partially blind person.
Yeah.
doing this sort of thing.
Yeah,
which is unusual. I mean, there aren't too many blind people that go into a field like that.
And I think again, those three things, lack of access to mathematics, graphical user interfaces, and graphically displayed data, those tend to filter out people. As you know, in schools, they're not. Well, people aren't. I don't know. If you listen to counselors, you might say you're not encouraged. But mostly, people I think would follow their own desires, but about what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like I did from science fiction, I learned to love science. But I think there are barriers, the real barriers, and you have to be able to overcome them. And maybe some of them you can't overcome. Some of the barriers are mental. You may not have the mental power to do it, or determination, or real love of it. If you love what you do, you're going to the probability of success is much greater than if you just like it or mildly like it or not sure. If you're not sure and they throw you into class, calculus, trigonometry, that sort of thing, and it's going to be so painful for you, and you don't see the benefit or feel the joy of the underlying science, then you're not going to make it. You'll get filtered out. So, a very small incidence population. I know there's a gentleman here named Robert Shelton in Houston who is the other really blind science type, space science type person I know. I know that there's people working for the companies around Clear Lake.
Yeah.
Clear Lake is where the Johnson Space Center is.
Sure.
And there's several people there who are blind and work around it. But Robert Shelton is the only blind space science person I know of besides myself. And he also be someday put on your show. He'd be very good. Also,
he really would. But I have done. I cannot think of this fellow's name that works at the SETI Institute. Did a show with him, and I don't know why. If we weren't trying to think of his name,
yeah, you could do it.
I could come up with it. But very bright fellow that works at SETI. Then I said, mentioned my friend Max Robinson, who has a degree in physics and taught physics at the university level for years.
Yeah.
The first show I ever did was with a little lady, and I'll never think of her name either, that works for NASA.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other blind people in the field. You
in the
all,
field, there
you
are
all
in the field, yeah.
To, you all need to get a list going.
I know.
Need to get a little list going. But, yes, you're right. The desire to do the thing that you want to do will many times propel you past obstacles that you have.
Yeah.
No question about that. And you wanted to be... you wanted a degree.
I wanted to be in space science, and I learned to love it, again, through science fiction, and just the general interest of how things work. And
yeah.
I found it romantically attractive, so it's part of the motivation to get it done.
Yeah, I've never, of course, not on the same scale you have, but I've always been a how do things work. You know, that's I ask that question everything I see.
Yeah.
How do they do that? How does that, you know?
Yeah.
My father's great question was, how do they keep that satellite in orbit? What keeps it from drifting? And he died before we ever, you know, before we ever knew it corrects itself. Obviously, mm-hmm. There'd be no other way to, there'd be no other way to do it. So you went to work for ExxonMobil. What do you do for them? Been your only job? So your first and only job?
That, yeah, besides the postdocs, I washed cars as a teenager. I'm not sure that counts.
Oh, no, that doesn't count. That's okay.
Oh, okay.
That's
that
good, though.
Count. But anyway, Exxon has been my job, and I've worked, they have this thing called Exxon Upstream Research Company, URC, here in Houston, and I worked for them up till 1996, and we dealt with what was called seismic migration. If you lay out a series of microphones on the surface, you can project sound into the ground and then listen. You know, either with dynamite or what's called vibrosize, you put vibrators on the surface and send sound energy into the ground, then you listen with this field of microphones. And what I spent most of my life on is trying to understand how you turn those into pictures once they come back. You're sitting at one geophone, and what you get is, say, over 5 seconds after you send off your burst of energy, you listen for 5 seconds, and you get this energy which comes back to you, but it may be reverberating from several reflectors in the ground. And in general, you don't know anything about the velocity or density of the material. So you take this field of microphones and take the data and try to analyze it to ways to tell you about the density and the velocity. And from that, you hope to get the content of what's underground, the general shapes. And I've spent most of my life trying to write for computer programs to do that.
You set off a charge of dynamite how far from the microphones? Deep in the ground?
There's ways to do it. I mean, I've seen these guys drill a bunch of posts in the ground so the dynamite is in the air. And they, excuse me a second, and they send an air blast into the ground.
Uh-huh.
Or they will dig a 10 or 20 foot hole and drop dynamite down it and blast that. But mostly because this tends to make cracks in people's houses and things.
Yeah, that, it would.
Well, they claim it does. Anyway, you set off some charges and everybody in the neighborhood is going to get their foundation restructured or something. Anyway, you have to. So what they use are vibrating trucks. So they take three or four trucks who have a large metal plate and they put it on the ground and the trucks literally lift themselves off and the entire weight of the truck is on this plate and then they shake the truck. It's a sweep. So you might say they start out with three or four where they pick the whole truck up and shake it three or four times a second, but the sweep can go to 20 or 30 times a second. So you have the vibrating trucks, and they can do it in a coordinated way. It's not as explosive, but you can, by mathematically, turn it into a very sharp spike by what's called deconvolution. Anyway, you make the effect of a very sharp spike using these vibrator trucks. And so you might say you send a spike of energy into the ground. Then every time the density of the ground changes, it reflects energy back to the surface. Not all the energy, but some of it. And there are certain conditions, and in certain cases, the energy will travel along. Okay, what I just told you was reflection, where the energy will hit a surface and,
uh-huh.
and reflect back to other microphones in your field. And there's a thing called refraction, where energy goes and stays on the surface and travels on the surface and then radiates out of the surface later. So you have reflection and refraction, and you have to try to understand. And all you have on the surface is a record of what noise you heard as a function of time. And you have to try to figure out what in the subsurface made up these various signals. And it's called, modeling. You literally take your best guess of what your subsurface looks like, then you mathematically model a response of that subsurface to your the seismic energy pour down through it, and you keep changing your model until it fits the signature that you see. So this is a, in general, what you hope at the end of the day is to get an accurate description of the structure of the subsurface, and then you hope to look at structures on the subsurface and figure out where oil might be, where it would be captured. What are called direct hydrocarbon indicators, where you try to see the oil directly, people are continuously trying that, and it's very an elusive thing, and hasn't really worked out as well as some people had hoped. So what we can do is try to figure, we can see the structures in the subsurface and then try to understand where oil might be trapped over time in those structures.
Okay, so there has been enough of this done so that when you do the shaking of the truck and the listening, you can tell pretty much what the ground 500 feet down is like? Or
yeah, down to, say, 20,000 feet.
Oh, 20,000
feet.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and you also have, you know, marine boats where they have air guns where they blast compressed air into the water. They used to do charges, but that's, you know, they do less of that.
Uh-huh.
And they have arrays of air guns, and then they stream out long cables with hydrophones on them, and they do this. They do the same thing for, you know, underwater to try to get the ground underneath the ocean, and that's where actually most of the activity is these days, offshore, because that's, you know, the world's 70% covered by water, so that's where most of the.
But what you're trying to determine is there a pocket of oil there? Is there
yes. Yeah, we'd like to be able to do that directly, but can't. What we end up determining is what is the shape of the ground underneath you, and would oil go there? Would oil evolve there or be trapped there by you know, various processes, chemical and processes over time, where you take carbon and, I mean, you take various fossil-type material and bake it for a long time and turn it into oil, and would it stay trapped there? Would it be stay trapped in these structures?
In other words, would this be the type of ground that would be that would possibly contain oil or trap oil, or would if
that's
would,
what you're trying
would
to
it
determine.
Be a good conductor? Would it be a good? I don't know what the word I'm looking for is.
Well, a good trap and seal. What you would like is a situation where oil would be both cooked, you know, created, and it would stay. Is there, you know, is the ground such that the oil would just migrate there and stay there? So then you have a likely target to go get it.
And that's the kind of place that, of course, Exxon would want.
Yes.
A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
In the interest of full disclosure, the site that I'm going to review this week, I am a member of the organization and former webmaster. The site is www.vibug.org, and Vibug stands for the Visually Impaired Blind Users Group. This is a blind computer users group here in Boston, where I live, which was started, about 15 years ago. And we meet once a month to discuss some of the latest new computer technology and to help each other with problems and so on and so forth that we're having with our computers. And the site has a wealth of information. Probably one of the most interesting things on the site is we record each month a demo that we do, a demonstration of a new product or some type of computer application that blind and visually impaired people can use, and we put it up on the site. And so you can go to the site and listen to all the past demos. I would give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 10. It is www.vibug.org. For blind sighting, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
No. know, there's. I keep hearing that there's lots of oil. It's just going to be harder to get.
Well, it's harder to get for several reasons. One, it's more and more remote areas, like deeper in the water. And also, it's in very becomes politically sensitive areas, like we're not allowed to drill off the coast of Florida. I can preach a little bit about people who don't want to see an oil well, but certainly, you know, drive and use air conditioning and all that sort of thing. Anyway, well, we won't preach too much. But also, there's politically unstable areas, like in Africa and sort of places. Anyway, so it becomes politically harder to get the oil. Also, there's a lot more competition for it. India and China are hugely emergent economies. And they are consuming vast quantities of energy, as are we. We're the leader, but they're coming up fast.
They want it, too.
They want it, too, and they have the resources to buy it and get it. And so, yeah, you can debate about when oil is going to run out, and everybody does. But right now, the oil has hit $62 a barrel, and it's staying there. So, well, people, you know, they can say there's plenty of oil, but still $62 a barrel.
We're at $52 a barrel today?
It was 62. Yeah.
We're going to have $90 a barrel oil in 5 years, aren't we?
I believe it.
You believe it?
Yeah.
I believe it, too. I don't know how the economy is going to... I don't know how we're going to be able to afford to drive. I don't know how we're going to be able to run the economy with $90 a barrel oil. And it's coming.
You know, the Europeans have a lot of experience with this because they've always made up these... They have very high oil prices due to their taxes. And so they have managed... And I mean, they've done a lot of bad things to their economy. But... And with things we think are just nuts, but at least in what I'm saying is price is going to make us do what we probably should have been doing for a long time: learn to conserve, learn to use more energy. You know, this is the trouble that GM has gotten itself into and Ford to a certain extent because they've been ignoring this. Whereas they can't build enough Priuses to meet the current demand.
Enough Toyotas.
Toyota Priuses.
Hybrid
cars?
Well, we're going to say, I read an article, I read the Atlantic magazine most months, and I read an article that says within 10 years it'll be GM Toyota.
Yeah.
GM. Yeah. Toyota GM or it will be, you know, the American car makers, the big three. Well, of course, Chrysler's already Daimler Chrysler.
Yes.
And they say that the other two are not going to be able to survive.
Yeah.
Building what they're building.
Well, they'll learn. They're going to learn real fast. I mean, Ford is already starting to deploy hybrids. They've been talking about the hybrid expedition-type vehicle for a long time, and I don't know if it's come out yet. But Ford is learning. I mean, GM, they're both learning, but they should have figured this out 5 years ago like the Toyota did.
Or back in the 70s. During the first oil, I remember KSPL. We're the station that's open on Sunday because all these gas stations were closed.
Yeah.
On Sunday, you couldn't buy gas, period. If you buy it on Saturday, you can go. You know, you can, and we're going to have $5 a gallon gas and $90 a barrel oil.
Yeah.
And it's
we'll learn if it's slow enough to make us be smarter and learn to use energy better. One of my fanaticisms is space science again, it's lunar solar power. There's people, especially at the University of Houston, who have been promoting this a lot, that you can put solar power bases on the moon and give you a great deal of energy. This is one thing I don't think NASA has talked about quite effectively enough. The reason for going back to the moon is I think it's a very good energy source. If you can build your base on the moon's horizon or limb so that you have a field of solar cells always illuminated at all times, and then you put what are called redirector satellites in high inclination orbits, and you can beam electrical energy to cities around the world no matter where the moon is. So when the moon is not in your sky, you can still get lunar solar power. And there are people at University of Houston who are trying to communicate this. And they're not getting a whole lot of hearing, but I'm very optimistic about this. And I'm actually very optimistic about the oil prices because it's going to make us try to get smarter. You know, and we haven't been all that smart.
And solar is obviously the answer.
I think, and what is called hydrogen fusion. There's a thing called ITER. It's an international consortium. They're starting to build a fusion reactor. It's probably mostly a research reactor. I think it's being built in France, I believe. And they just started it this year. But hydrogen fusion and solar, solar power, lunar solar power is my thing because it combines both space and a little less pollution, you know, energy source, which I think is would be a very good thing.
And we can go there, we know.
We can go there. And we need to do there much we need to go there much better with, you know, much better technology than we used last time.
Then we because it's been to 40 years, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead. We were talking about solar.
Okay. Well, again, that was a brief summary that you put solar cells on each side of the moon's horizon, so the sun. So no matter where the moon is, the sun is illuminating one of the two solar cells. You turn it into microwaves. You beam it at these redirector satellites in high inclination, like polar orbits, and they would beam it down to Earth cities, which receive it on what are called rectennas, which we might say are big square rectangles of on the ground. And they would be a mile or two square. The energy wouldn't be that high. That is to say, you wouldn't it wouldn't kill you if you walked in front of it, because you know, because it would recede over that square mile. So the energy wouldn't be deadly immediately. So that would that anyway. That would be a method for getting past the storage problem. You know, a lot of solar, because it gets dark at night, we don't have effective solar storage methods. So you could charge. You can't charge during the day and discharge all night. Not effectively, and where with this lunar solar power thing, it would always be illuminated, so you wouldn't have a storage issue. So anyway, I have a lot of optimism for that because it combines both high science and space and energy, which we sort of all the businesses I'm sort of in.
Well, I 25 years ago, I thought about solar, and I ordered some catalogs and stuff on it, and then I talked to some people lately, and there hadn't really been that much progress made.
No, on the ground solar, it hasn't. They're still expensive. The price is coming down slowly, but if you built these things on the moon, you could build out of lunar material. You wouldn't have to haul the stuff up there, and you could, you know, get robots to make as many cells as you want. You just let them turn them loose and let them build away and keep adding on to your own facilities. In the space, you have a lot more solar spectrum to work with. The ultraviolet, where a lot more energy is, so your cells would be easy, become much more efficient. I think cells can be made about 25% efficient now, you know, given you have the full solar spectra, because there's no air, obviously, on the moon, so you have the spectra all the time. On the ground Earth here, you'd have to. It becomes complicated because you have clouds, and you have to keep your cells sort of pointed at the sun, and that takes motors and things. But the biggest thing is it's night half the time, and that's no solar energy at night. You
know? But with the moon, one side of the moon is always pointed at the sun.
It changes sides. You know, it's rotating slowly, too. I mean, the moon goes around the Earth once every month, essentially. So, yes, one of the sides of the moon is always illuminated.
Some
and
surface of the moon is always.
Based on the horizon of the moon's or limb, you could put a solar field on each side of that base, and so one of those fields would always be illuminated, so your transmitters would always be in use.
And then we would beam this from the moon
to polar orbiting satellites.
To polar orbiting satellites.
These are redirector satellites.
Who would beam it back to large metropolitan areas areas that need much electricity.
Yeah, so it wouldn't matter where the moon was in its orbit. I mean, like the moon, I'm lost track, I don't know if it's up or not, but even if it wasn't in your sky, you could still get energy from it.
Okay, but in the sun, in the day, we'd get that same energy from the sun.
Well, I mean, if you want to put extra cells, I mean, it wouldn't matter day or night because the cells, I mean, the energy would always be floating to you.
The moon would always is always there.
Yeah, it's always there.
And you can't see it because of the sun, or you can't see it
it's either on the because of the sun or it's on the other side of the Earth.
Other side of the Earth. Okay.
Even if it's on the other side of the Earth.
The redirector satellites would take care of
energy.
That.
Yeah.
Boy, you talk about science fiction. That's my wife is going to love this.
Yeah, we can.
She's
email you some papers on it.
Oh, yes. She's going to be big into this.
Well, I'll send you a paper.
This is the sort of thing that you know, when you think about it and you consider my father was born in 1905 and 1920 when he was a teenager, if you'd said, Harry Parr, there will come a day before you die that you will be able to ride down the freeway and talk to anybody in the world you want to from your car with a thing smaller than a pack of cigarettes, he'd have said, you're full of you-know-what.
Yeah, I
know. He said, you're crazy. That'll never happen. That's out of the and it happened. He died in 2001. It happened in his lifetime.
Yeah.
He wasn't around that sort of technology because he he didn't, his mind didn't go away, but he just wouldn't have been interested. You couldn't have explained it to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was alive when it happened, but to tell him that when he was 15 years old, he'd have said, that's crap, that's not ever going to happen.
Yeah.
And your theory seems as far out as no more further out than he would have thought cell phones were.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to have heavy motivation to do this stuff because the energy prices are going up. There's heavy competition for it. Coal is dirty. Even the clean coal technology means they remove the carbon dioxide from coal before they feed it to you in various forms. And that carbon dioxide is going to go somewhere. So I think because of the energy competition or lack of energy, clean energy, I think this is will become more and more practical.
Yeah, because we can't. I can afford $5 a gallon gas if we don't drive too much. But most people can't. A lot of people can't, and I really can't. I mean, you know, I can because we'll have to drive, and that's what we'll have to do. But you know, the people on fixed incomes, people living close to the poverty level just won't be able to drive cars, and automobiles have been one of the great things that's kept this country.
Well, they still will. It'll just be of a different type. You could, hydrogen sort of, but the methods for producing hydrogen now all start with hydrocarbons. I'm also mildly pro nuclear fission, the current reactor. You can build safer reactors than we've been allowed to build.
Yeah.
The New Energy Bill has money for at least 5 new reactors in the U.S. because we haven't built any since the Three Mile Island issue.
Yeah, since a long time.
But if you take that, you can turn water into hydrogen. From the electricity from nuclear plants and then ship it hydrogen around. We'll have cars. It's just a little smaller and run on different things.
Yeah. Well, interesting. I guess we could talk about this all day, couldn't we? Because you are, it is one of your favorite subjects.
Yeah.
At this moment, what do you do for Exxon? You're doing computer work, right now?
I'm doing a little bit of three things. In a way, the seismic field is mature, and they're doing less research in it than they used to, so they're vendorizing a lot of their efforts. So there's less work to be done there, and what I am drifting into is what's called distributed job management, which is computer methods. If you have clusters of computers, you want to send jobs to them in efficient manners. That is to say, you want to send out a job, find a computer that's free, available. You want to send the job there, track it, and get the job back to the user. I'm working on that a little bit. I'm also working on gravity magnetics programs. Besides seismic, oil companies do other types of remote sensing, which they will take a aircraft and fly it over a field and measure both the gravitational and magnetic properties of an area, and so they get a field of data. And from this, they try to determine what are the shapes of the object in the subsurface. Again, that would generate these gravity and magnetic fields. You think gravity all comes from the center of the Earth, but locally gravity does vary a lot due to the shapes of the local subsurface.
You mean the strength of gravity varies
where you are on the Earth. It
You're
varies
kidding.
Locally.
I have no idea.
It does, and because, like, if you have a chunk of metal underneath you, you're going to have stronger gravity than if there were just, like, water underneath you or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So you get gravitational changes, and from these gravitational changes, if you have a whole field of data, you can try to understand what shapes are the masses in the subsurface. Again, because the masses will be of different densities and produce different gravitational fields. And magnetism is the same way. So anyway, I'm beginning to work at that. I'm just barely starting. We have work to be done there. And, yeah, I guess that would be about it, those two things right now.
It is.
Distributed job management and gravitation. Also, I'm trying to come up under the .NET. I work with Unix, UNIX operating system.
Uh-huh.
And our company wants to put a lot more stress on the Microsoft Windows and what is called the .NET environment. And I'm switching over to that. Obviously, I use word processing and Excel and all that stuff, but to actually do programming, and it is new to me, and I'm trying to learn the Visual Studio .NET systems 2003, 2005,
yeah,
and just become proficient in that mode of development. there's been a real problem with for the blind in computer programming, because these graphically designed programming tools, which you literally draw pictures, and you can design your programs, and to a certain point, those pictures can even generate program code. And the blind have not been able to participate in that. And there's a little progress in that, and I think in VisualStudio.net is bringing more. But basically, when you design a program by drawing, it puts us at a large disadvantage. And so we're trying to deal with some of that those issues by going to .NET
Now, NASA is you're doing this to benefit blind people, or you're doing
this to stay alive?
You're doing it to maintain your job.
Yeah,
to keep
maintain
your...
my own job schedule. And,
I got you.
And then, you know, you help people in the interim because, there's lots of listservs out there that deal with this sort of thing. Blindprogramming.com and all this sort of thing. So you can get... help, and you also try to be of help, and you guys, we teach each other things.
Sure.
And the Europeans are being very active. They've developed a system which will allow you to read diagrams. Diagrams are stored in what's called Uniform Modeling Language, UML, and the Europeans have come up with a method to read this and turn it into text descriptions. So people can draw circuit diagrams and program diagrams, and the blind are just beginning to start being able to read these things.
All right,
because they're converted into text.
We are completely out of time. I want to get back to you at some point in time and see where we are in the development of alternative energy sources, see what Exxon is doing, and check with you. But it seems like you have a very interesting job and are dealing with blindness quite well, sir.
Thank you.
We thank you for coming. Lewis Mayer from Houston, Texas. Thank you, sir. Lewis Mayer from Houston, Texas. What an interesting fellow he is. I've got to get he and our friend Max Robinson together. So I think they will probably have a lot to talk about, wouldn't you think? So if you'd like to be a guest on Blind Like Me, we'd like to have you. You can write me, email me at phil@philpar.net. Just phil@philpar.net. And that's one of the email addresses I check every day, and that will get you in touch with me. That would be the best thing, since that way I would have your address and contact information at my fingertips in my little guest file for Blind Like Me. So come and join us. Come and be a guest if you think you would enjoy that sort of thing. We'd like to have you. You don't have to be a rocket scientist like this fellow was. Just be dealing with blindness. That's all we require, that you are a blind or partially blind person, and that you're dealing with it day to day and living as normal a life as possible. I hate to use the word normal, but I just did, didn't I? Anyway, Phil at philpar.net, that will do you. And thanks for listening, and don't know who we'll have on next week, but I'm sure it'll be someone interesting. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.